You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Archaeology Show with Chris Webster on KNVC 95.1 FM, Carson City Community Media in Carson City, Nevada, and online at knvc.org/listen-live. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the topics you really want to know about. Welcome to the show. Hello, listeners and fans of archaeology. I'm your host for the next hour, Chris Webster. I'm a contract archaeologist, and in the field we call cultural resources management. I also run the Archaeology Podcast Network. We have a lot of shows about archaeology, and you can find them all at www.archpodnet.com.
Hey, everybody. Chris Webster jumping in from the editing room. This is a recording from my radio show on Carson Community Media, as I just mentioned on the recording. So I'm going to mention throughout the phone number to call in. I'm not going to take any of that stuff out because I do this show every Friday from noon to 1 Pacific date time, as we're in daylight savings time. And you can tune in at knvc.org/listen-live. So ignore the call-in stuff, but feel free to send emails and tweets to the addresses mentioned. All right, on to the show.
This is first and foremost a call-in show. Call in with your questions to 775-515-4141. That's 775-515-4141. You can also tweet your questions to Archaeowebby, at Archaeowebby, ArchaeoWebby, or at ArcPodNet. I'll be mostly monitoring those on the back end here. I prefer you called in. In the studio with me for a second time is archaeologist Richie Cruz. Welcome, Richie.
Thank you.
I almost called you Richard Cruz for some reason.
Oh, that's definitely not my name.
Like somebody we used to know called you that actually on a report.
Really?
And I had to change that, yes.
Gross.
Richie Cruz. All right, so today I'm talking with Samantha Kirkley of Project Archaeology. She is currently the state coordinator for Project Archaeology in Utah and adjunct faculty in anthropology at Southern Utah University. She earned a master's degree in anthropology from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. She has worked professionally in cultural resources management in Nebraska, Missouri, Utah, and Nevada since 2007. Her professional career took an unexpected and fulfilling turn when she attended the Project Archaeology Leadership Academy in Bozeman, Montana in 2013. I love Bozeman, by the way. Bozeman's great. Since that time, she has held several teacher workshops throughout the state of Utah, co-authored the first Utah-based Project Archaeology curriculum investigating a Fremont pit house, has organized and managed several archaeology Girl Scout and 4-H camps, working collaboratively with local tribes to bring indigenous educators to speak to K-12 students and participate in community programs is her greatest joy. So let's bring her on right now. Sam, welcome to the show. Sam, can you hear us? I just turned the phone on, so probably everyone else can hear you. Can you hear us now?
Maybe.
Yes, I can hear you.
Fantastic. I'm cool. Still new at the radio game, so sometimes I don't push the right buttons. There you go. All right, and as I mentioned in the introduction, Richie is on the line. Say hi to Richie real quick.
Hello there. How are you?
Hey, Richie.
Great. So we're both archaeologists, and you're an archaeologist, and we want to talk about what Project Archaeology is. So let's just dive right into that. What is Project Archaeology? What's your elevator pitch when somebody says, what the heck is this thing?
Okay, well, Project Archaeology is a national heritage education program. It's a not-for-profit, and it was started back in the 1990s as a kind of an interagency effort to thwart vandalism, because that is definitely a problem.
Yeah. And started by who? Started by what agency?
It was primarily the Bureau of Land Management. Okay. But all of the agencies at the time were involved in its creation. So mm-hmm. Park Service, Forest Service, and state, you know.
Okay.
So.
All right. Well, that's cool. So let's talk about a little bit about what Project Archaeology does. But before that, who can participate in Project Archaeology? Now, we're under the assumption that no one on this radio show has heard of Project Archaeology, so we're going to ask you a lot of questions about that. So is it agency archaeologists that are doing this, members of the public? How are people getting into this, and who is it?
Fantastic question. It is actually a network of teachers, so K-12 teachers, professors, indigenous tribes, agency folks, museum people. Mm-hmm. I mean, pretty much a pretty wide gamut of people are involved in this effort, I would say.
Okay. So
and can be involved, I guess.
Well, that's great. That's great. So give me an idea about, you know, what a typical Project Archaeology project is like. You know, what are we doing here? You said it was initially started to combat vandalism, but what are we doing with this now? What is a typical project?
Okay. Well, you know, the biggest thing that we do and that was started at that time in the 90s was to produce really high quality professional development and curriculum for K-12 teachers. Because let's just face it, if you want to get something out to the public, I mean, if a teacher teaches 30 students in one classroom every single year and you calculate all the teachers that there are in the country, that's a pretty good group of people to reach, right?
That's a good group of people.
And you know how kids are, you know, as soon as you teach them that they need to brush their teeth, they go home and have everybody brush their teeth over and over.
Right.
So I would say producing curriculum that is aligned with national standards, that is collaboratively mm-hmm. Produced is probably the biggest thing that we do. And then the professional development workshops throughout the country is, you know, we got to get it to the teachers. So that's probably the biggest part.
So if a teacher is kind of a self-starter, can they just find the information online and then go from there?
Absolutely. Projectarchaeology.org.
Okay, great. Together. Well, we will have that. If you happen to be listening to the podcast version of this, we will have that in the show notes at arcpodnet.com. And mm-hmm. it's actually /archaeology/63 is the episode this is going to be. Oh. However, if you're listening on the radio, projectarchaeology.org. This goes out in multiple ways. So you mentioned also having the workshops, which I think are really cool because sometimes people just need to be shown something. I mean, I'm sort of in software development, and we can put the software out there all we want, but if we don't show people how to use it, sometimes they just don't get it.
Yeah.
So what are some of these workshops like? Are they multi-day? Is it one day? Do they come in? Do they get to do any archaeology, or is it, you know, showing them how to use the lesson plans and curriculum? How do those look?
Okay. Workshops look really differently throughout the country, depending on what curriculum we want to introduce or, you know, what funding is available. You know how that goes.
Yeah, yeah.
I think typically for a workshop would look like maybe 3 days. I know that seems like a big time commitment, but we like to model the lessons. And let's just say for a curriculum like Investigating Shelter, which is my absolute favorite curriculum, that would, you know, there's 9 lessons and we model all of the lessons for the teachers because, like you say, it's really a lot easier to pick up something and run with it when you've seen it in action.
Nice. Yeah.
And then we always have a field trip day. You asked about hands-on. So not all of those experiences are necessarily survey or excavation or maybe some of the things we typically associate with archaeology, but we usually take educators out to an archaeological site.
Okay.
And probably the even bigger part of that is that we always invite an indigenous community member. Now that could be a descendant of a slave from mm-hmm. Virginia or a descendant from the ancestral Puebloans or something
sure.
like that. But having someone from one of those groups to come and really make the connection to the place mm-hmm. is key. And that's been my experience anyway.
Interesting. Okay. Do you do the same thing for like the mining curriculums, like the historic archaeology stuff?
Definitely. In fact, we did a workshop in Utah at the John Jarvie Ranch, which is Ooh. Kind of at a crossroads between Wyoming and Colorado and Utah, and it was kind of a ferry boat place, and, you know, like I said, kind of a historic crossroads location. And we actually had the great granddaughter of the man who started that little ferry station come to the workshop, and that was just amazing. And she had some of like the family heirlooms and things that she brought, and it really brought it brought so much more to the teachers, you know, to connect to at the workshop.
Okay,
so.
Do teachers have to pay to go to these things, or is it fully funded for them to go there, besides travel probably?
Sure. That really depends, again, on where you are in the country and what kind of funding you have, and who are your sponsors. And, you know, out west we have some agreements with the agencies, you know, BLM or whoever, that kind of support these kinds of workshops. They like to support these kinds of things, whereas maybe back east, you don't have as much maybe support that way, and you get more support from state historical societies or different other entities like that.
Okay. Well, I want to dive in a little bit into what one of these curriculums is like. That's an interesting word. Curriculums is like. Right. And so one of the ones we mentioned in your bio is the investigating a Fremont Pit House one, which I think is a good thing to talk about for this particular show, because this radio show is designed for a wider audience, a general public that may or may not know a whole lot about archaeology. So first, give us a quick synopsis on what is a Fremont Pit House? Like, where are these things located, and what do they look like? Let's do a little archaeology lesson first.
Oh, I like it. Well, I guess I would say, first of all, the reason we developed Investigating Shelter was because, well, one of the reasons is because it is a common or a basic human need. So it is universal. All people need some kind of shelter. So that's something where everyone can start at, you know, common ground. And then from that, over the years, we have developed a number of shelter, actual like archaeological sites that are shelter based. And there is a database online that teachers can access, and they can pull from a good sized database of different shelters located throughout the United States. Like I said, they could investigate an authentic slave cabin in Virginia, or they can look at a Pawnee earthen lodge in Kansas, or, you know, like a Fremont Pit House.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and really bring that to life in their classroom. So that's really an exciting thing to me. So Fremont Pit House, a pit house, especially a Fremont Pit House, I guess, would be somewhat a subterranean earthen and structure with some sticks piled up on top and some dirt piled over the top of that. I'm trying to think of how to describe this really simply. But
that sounds about right.
So it's not a complete hole in the ground. It's just maybe 2 feet deep, and and then some large branches and sticks kind of peaked over the top of that, and then dirt and mud piled around that. And then, of course, you would access it by a ladder from the top, which is also where, you know, smoke would come out from your little fire.
Yeah.
So,
that sounds good. And so listeners can kind of envision that. I mean, it's they would dig down a little ways. And that's pretty common, I think, for early house structures, because one of the things it helps do is it helps kind of secure the poles that help make the rest of the structure. But also, you know, if you're getting down deep like that, especially in some of these windy areas like Utah, and, you know, there's what's just kind of like always windy like it is here in Nevada, right, too. You can just get down and kind of get out of the wind a little bit if you want to, if you get down deep enough. But then it's a huge amount of resources to dig a super deep hole and make your entire house subterranean. But these pit houses were nice and pretty easy to manufacture, I think.
Yeah, and I think another great thing about the pit house is that it's relatively cool in the summer and relatively warm in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of has the best of both. You know, it's kind of like you have a little bit of a basement, like we have basements in our houses, and then and then you have a little bit of upstairs, sort of, I mean, in a way.
Indeed.
But it is a perfectly suited shelter for the Great Basin, for Northern Paiute, Southern Paiute. I mean, I say Northern and Southern Paiute, but, you know, their ancestors is what I mean to say.
Yeah, indeed.
So.
Okay. So what else you know, that's what a Fremont Pitt House is. So what does this curriculum look like that you're giving to teachers? How are they teaching students about a Fremont Pitt House?
Excellent. Well, like I said, the investigating shelter is its own curriculum piece, and there are 9 lessons. Mm-hmm. And the Fremont Pitt House would be inserted, kind of, is like an insert at lesson number 8. So wherever you are in the country, if you have investigating shelter curriculum, then you can pull whatever shelter investigation you want to do for lesson 8. So I'm just going to fast forward to lesson 8 and say, because, you know, lessons 1 through 7, essentially students are getting the tools to work with the material in lesson 8. So it kind of builds on itself. It's not just little standalone pieces. It's something that they build upon their knowledge as they go. So by the time that they get to the investigation of the shelter, in this case, Fremont Pitt House, then they actually, the investigation is divided into 4 parts. And the first part is the geography. And in the geography, this is where the students, you know, learn about the terrain, like what does it look like here and what kind of animals are around. And also just a little quick snip of who were the people that lived in this area and who are their ancestors today? I mean, sorry, their descendants today.
Right.
And then we move on into the history section. And then in the history part, we delve even deeper into the modern descendants of that culture. And then we look at historic photographs, if they're available. And if they're not available, we get really great illustrators to put together what we think a pit house looks like.
Yeah.
And then they look a little bit more into, you know, just uncovering the history. And we put, we have a descendant community member. In this specific unit, we have Delvern Pickovit, who lives in Richfield right now, and his wife, and they actually talk about what their oral history tells them about the Pitt House, that Fremont culture. And then it goes on to the archaeology section, which is where we actually talk about you know, the footprint of the Pitt House. We kind of teach what that is. You know, what do archaeologists actually see when they're excavating?
Yeah.
And so then we have this map included in there, and it's not made up data. Like I said, it's all authentic. And the map is of just one of the Pitt House structures that was actually excavated at Five Finger Ridge. Five Finger Ridge is just west of Richfield, Utah, and there is now the Fremont Indian State Park there that kind of interprets that area. So, you know, people can actually go there to this location and learn about it, and which I would strongly recommend if you can. I mean, if you're in a location to be able to get there,
sure,
because it would be a great supplement to this curriculum.
Where's that located again?
Fremont Indian State Park.
Yeah.
And that is just west of Richfield, Utah, on I-70.
Okay.
It's a really cool place to visit.
Nice.
So they do that investigation. They kind of do reverse archaeology. They take the artifacts and they put them back onto the map of the, you know, the footprint of the Pitt House.
Mm-hmm.
And then they do some analysis of, you know, what happened here and how do we know and, you know, what do these artifacts tell us, this kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. And then the final section is on today. So it's part 4 and it's titled Today, which, again, brings in more oral history from Mr. Pickovit and also some information from archaeologist Richard Talbot. And because he was one of the archaeologists that worked on that project.
Okay.
And then that's kind of it. And then they do, when they get done with the curriculum, they do a final performance of understanding where they kind of take all of their knowledge and they're put into a scenario to be in a city council, and they're all divided into groups of archaeologists and developers and indigenous members and families that want to move into new houses. And they have this dilemma that they have to solve of, here's this place that has all this, Fremont Pitt houses on it, but, you know, these developers want to build houses there, and these people want to move into the houses. Mm-hmm. And they have to kind of think about the perspectives of all those people and really come together on ultimately a conclusion that will be, I guess, beneficial to everyone as right. best as it can be.
So, okay. All right.
That's pretty much it.
that sounds really cool. I really like that. That's such a neat way to present archaeology.
Everybody, Chris Webster here to talk about Team Black. Team Black is a website at arccert.black. However, we've started a Patreon page, and I've got a ton of videos up there right now and more coming soon. I actually exceeded my upload limit for this week, if you're listening to this in real time. So there will be more coming out next week. But we have a lot of really good stuff up there at patreon.com/teamblack. Check it out at a number of levels. There's some really great stuff from Dr. Alan Garfinkel on Native American issues and perspectivism and animism and all kinds of different things. And that's at the $10 crew chief level, I believe we called it. So check that out. I mean, you can watch all the stuff in 1 month. I don't care. And then get rid of it. But just tell people about it. Share it. Because the more patrons we get, the more regular patrons you get, the more we're able to do this. And the more experts I can contract to create videos that you guys want and need and can benefit from. So this isn't just for archaeologists. This is for anyone that wants to learn. So go over and check that out. Patreon.com/teamblack. Hey, Chris Webster jumping in one more time to talk about our membership system at the APN. So again, just like Team Black, we need to keep the lights on over here. Costs a lot of time and effort to do the editing and keep this thing going. So we have a lot of other shows if you don't listen to them. They're all at arcpodnet.com or search Archaeology Podcast Network on your podcast player of choice. And you'll find about 10, actually you'll find about 20 shows because we have a bunch in our back catalog. But to keep all that going, to keep all that rolling, we need some members. So head on over to arcpodnet.com/members. And at the pro level, if you just heard the ad for Team Black, at the pro level, you actually get all that for free. There's a special page on the APN, and you can get all the videos that I put up over there are included on the APN side. And you get all that stuff as part of your professional membership with the Archaeology Podcast Network. So check it out, arcpodnet.com/members. Now back to the show.
Just to remind everybody, you are listening to KNVC 95.1 FM, Carson City Community Media. And if you're listening online, please chime in. Hit us up on Twitter or our Facebook page, ArcPodNet, on Facebook. And if you're not listening online, you can listen online, knvc.org/listen-live. You can call in 775-515-4141 with questions about archaeology, about Utah archaeology, about anything. I'm sure between the three of us, we can answer your questions about something. And then, like I said, tweet to ArchaeoWebby or at ArcPodNet. Okay. So getting back to some archaeology here, this is really cool. And when you mentioned the first seven lessons that kind of teach them foundational skills, my first thought was, I wish some archaeologists we know had gone through those first seven lessons.
Yeah.
The training is not always consistent. People get in the field. No. So what are the ages of kids that, what's the age range that kids are learning this? I think I mentioned that partly in the bio, but just again, what is the age range that people are looking at for this curriculum?
For investigating shelter, this is specifically aligned to national standards, next generation science standards for third through fifth grade.
Okay.
However, I always advocate teaching this to all ages, kind of what you just said.
Yeah.
In fact, I've actually taught this whole curriculum to my freshman students in anthropology, and they loved it.
Yeah.
So
nice. Okay.
Yeah. And we do have other curriculums that are geared to other ages. One is called Food and Land, and it's kind of a kind of an extension, I call it, of investigating shelter, and it takes you out onto the land, you know, the broader scope, the broader geography, looking at landscape, looking at foodways. And it's the very first one that we just barely completed is actually designed for the Great Basin.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And it and that was developed in Nevada. So so there you guys go.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
investigating the wiki up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and we do have a Great Basin wiki up investigation. And
yeah,
that was from Oregon, a site in Oregon.
Okay.
But anyway, and then currently we're working on investigating migration, which is kind of a little bit heavy GIS based, and mm-hmm. it's for 7th through 9th grade.
Okay.
So, and then investigating nutrition is focused on world history. It looks at three different sites in Syria,
mm-hmm.
and examines the differences in food over time in domesticated versus, you know, hunting for food. And so, yeah, that's specifically for sixth grade.
Cool.
So,
it's interesting. Yeah. How would you integrate GIS into a program?
Well, we're in the middle of doing it right now.
Nice.
well, most of it has been written, and I do GIS work kind of, that's kind of one of my hobby things actually. Mm-hmm. And so we're making it where there is an actual, you know, curriculum guide, just like all of the others, but that the students will go online to the ArcGIS online.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll actually look at story maps. Like we're developing the story maps right now for this migration. Yeah. And then they will create their own. So it's kind of, again, it's building blocks. They kind of do these building blocks. And then at the end, that's kind of their final performance, is they create their own story map on ArcGIS online.
Neat. That puts them ahead of some master's degree students, I know.
Yeah,
well,
indeed.
You know.
Nice. How often does material get, I don't want to say refreshed, because even if you put together a curriculum, you know, years ago, there's probably still quite a bit of validity to it. But how often do new curriculums come into the system? And do you retire some of the older ones or kind of spruce them up a little bit over time?
That's a really great question, because, you know, education standards, as we know, are constantly changing, it seems. And you have to stay up with that if you want to be relevant mm-hmm. and useful to educators. The first curriculum that was produced was called Intrigue of the Past. And while a number of people still use Intrigue of the Past, including, you know, some archaeologists that I know in the Forest Service and, you know, kind of other places, we kind of retired it. And then change the development to fit the educational needs of the time. So,
right.
Just 10 or 11 years ago is when investigating shelter came into being, and that is aligned to the national standards. And a lot of the lessons from Intrigue of the Past, that retired one, actually are pulled back into some of the curriculums that are created now, because they're still really great lessons. They just weren't adapted to the needs of the time. So we are kind of piecing those into the new curriculums as they seem to fit.
Okay. So, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Sounds good. I had a question here because I had a vague understanding of what Project Archaeology was, but I'll still kind of try to rephrase this. But my original question was, how does a new project get submitted to Project Archaeology? But I guess my revised question is, how do you decide what kind of sites to focus on? Do you say, well, we want to teach this basically, and then look for a site within agency lands to fit that? Or how does that work? Yeah.
Depending on how to answer that. Yeah. I would say that some of the curriculums have come from, yes, us seeing a niche, a need that mm-hmm. teachers have. You know, some teachers are, you know, contact us and say, hey, I teach this in this state, and it would really be great if we had something da-da-da-da-da. And then we look for, you know, people that can fund that kind of a project.
Right.
But I would say a lot of projects also come from maybe from mitigation.
Okay. You
know, maybe there needs to be a site mitigated or something like that. And instead of making 10,000 flyers to send out to people that no one ever looks at, maybe we can put that money towards something that is enduring and impacting, that goes to teachers and students all across the country.
Yeah, go figure.
So, yeah. So that's actually, you know, Food and Land came out of a project in a pretty large project in Nevada.
Oh, really?
It was great. But, you know, that Food and Land project was always in the wings, and it was kind of already in development. It was just kind of waiting. And then this project came up in Nevada, and, you know, the BLM archaeologist there contacted the national office, and it was just, you know, serendipitous in that scenario.
Nice.
Yeah. So I would say if you have a really great idea for a project, for a shelter, or for a place-based project like Fort Meade, you know, we have one that's specifically for Fort Meade. We also have Roman Villa. That was kind of a specific curriculum.
Yeah.
If you have some ideas, I would just say, you know, contact the national office, and they would be, you know, thrilled to hear from you and talk with you about it. And then hopefully we can, either if you know how to get the funding, or if you don't, then maybe we can figure out the funding for it.
I was thinking, man, Roman Villa, there's not too many of those in National Park Service or BLM land these days.
No, there's not. But there's a great need for world history curriculum that's a little deeper, you know, deepens the curriculum a bit.
Sure. That makes me think, has anybody in the Project Archaeology system considered like officially partnering with other countries in producing stuff like this, or, you know, somewhat in an official capacity? Or are you guys just putting stuff together in order to teach people about that stuff? Or are you actually partnering with them?
I don't really know the answer to that exactly.
Sure.
I do know that, so Investigating Nutrition, that's the one for sixth grade world history.
Okay.
That was a partnered effort between the Oriental Institute in Chicago and Project Archaeology in Bozeman. And the Oriental Institute, of course, has amazing collections from, you know, the Middle East and all of those locations. And so they were the perfect people to do this project because they had the data to look at the three sites in Syria and to, you know, come up with all of that. So, and then there's also a shelter investigation for Iraq.
Okay.
You know, for a shelter in Iraq. Now, I don't know how much involvement from other countries, you know, there has been on those projects. That is not something I'm aware of. I just know that we do have a couple of, you know, the Roman Villa, the shelter in Iraq, and the, Investigating Nutrition.
Okay.
And those are world pieces, but I don't know. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, that's all right. Yeah. You know, I was wondering, so you mentioned, we mentioned in your bio that you're adjunct faculty in anthropology at Southern Utah University. Oh. So that's clearly one of your jobs. Is Project Archaeology another job, or is that a volunteer effort within the agencies?
Oh.
It started out volunteer.
Yeah.
It is now supplemented through the Bureau of Land Management and the university.
Nice.
And hopefully other partners in the future. I hope.
Yeah.
That's really the idea. I mean, like I said, this effort started out as an interagency effort.
Yeah.
And it really is an interagency concern.
Right.
You know, vandalism isn't seemingly going away, and not only disrespect of things of the past, but there's an overall disrespect of people today, of you know, people alive today. And so I think that was really the beautiful thing that has come out of Project Archaeology that was kind of unexpected. Our our recently retired director, Dr. Jeannie Moe, said that when they were developing these curriculums, they were trying to make something that was really great for teachers and got kids really excited about science,
mm-hmm.
you know, the science of archaeology. And when they did evaluations, so they did some assessments of classes, you know, classrooms of children that have gone through this curriculum. And the thing that the kids said was that they would remember about archaeology in years to come was that when we, if we destroy rock art, we are hurting the feelings of the descendants of the people that had made it.
Yeah.
Like, that was the takeaway. Like, that's what these, like, third and fourth grade kids are coming away with, was like, oh, we're hurting people that are living today that are descendants of the people that made this stuff or lived here or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's huge. I mean, that really transcends archaeology in my mind.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that teaches them just compassion for fellow humans, which is weirdly lacking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly. Or at least compassion for natives.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just compassion for people in general. So, yeah, that's really neat. I think what we do here at the Archaeology Podcast Network and then for this radio show is really in line with all that. It's just educating people, not just about cool things in archaeology, but about really the responsibility to history and preservation and ancestors and then descendants and in the whole picture.
Yeah. You know,
yes.
You know, I've been curious. Like, I noticed most of these lesson plans actually incorporate a DVD. Like, is that meant for people who can't travel to these sites, or is that meant more for, like, you know, like introducing each section?
That's great. I think for both purposes, I think mm-hmm. that, you know, if you've been to a workshop, then it's a nice refresher to see those little pieces of the lesson. That's what it is. It's actually videos of instructors teaching those lessons. So it's kind of a refresher for how to do that. And
okay.
then, and I think for people that can't make it to a workshop, I think it will help them to be guided in how to instruct. And so... And they can look at those online as well at the projectarchaeology.org under teachers.
Oh.
There's a lot of those videos there.
Oh, really?
So,
you don't need a code or anything. You just, like, go to the, you know, the website?
Yeah, you just get on the website, go to teachers, and then I think you just scroll down for a second, and there's a whole, like, series of videos you can watch with the different shelter lessons.
Cool.
Really cool.
Yeah.
So let's do a couple more questions here on this. Yeah. So... especially for people listening to the podcast version of this show, we do get a number of agency archaeologists listening to the podcast from various agencies. How does somebody get involved in this? I'm sure they probably know how if they're at an agency, but how does somebody maybe wanting to go work for a federal agency or something like that, how do they get involved with Project Archaeology and helping put this curriculum together and help with the workshops?
I think, you know, you would be surprised. There's actually a lot of archaeologists in all the agencies that haven't heard of Project Archaeology are not really sure how it can function for them. I would say the best thing to do would be to, if you don't know who the state coordinator is simply to go to projectarchaeology.org and contact Erica Malo or anyone there at the national office to get a project going or to get some ideas about how to. Like I said, maybe if you need to mitigate some sites or if you have funding in your offices and you want to do something that's really worthwhile, that's really going to make an impact in years to come, I would definitely say give this a go because maybe you could fund a workshop or maybe you could fund a curriculum and a workshop or, you know, there's some opportunities there. We've also done Girl Scout camps and we've had those funded through the BLM or, you know, other entities. And those have been really impacting as well. So,
okay. Well, great. So I guess just to kind of wrap this interview up, is there anything you wanted to mention about Project Archaeology that we haven't asked you so far?
Oh, wow.
I know. Big question. All the things.
So open-ended. Well, you know, I always wanted to be an archaeologist my whole life. And everybody that knows me knew that. And, and you know, there was a time when I was questioning what I was doing. And, you know, I just thought, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I'm not really changing the world or, you know, anything fantastic. So maybe I need to change what I'm doing. And, and you know, I got this email and I took it to heart and I went to Leadership Academy with Project Archaeology. And like I said, it changed my life.
Nice.
And I really saw the purpose of archaeology at that time, because I realized that it was really a way to unify people and, and to, in a way that's not offensive or, you know, like we see so many offensive, distressing things on social media and the news, but it's surprisingly, an amazing way to, address social issues.
Mm-hmm.
And bringing people together in a non-threatening way.
Yeah.
And I've seen so many, I could just, you know, we could spend days just talking about all the stories of teachers, of Girl Scouts, 4-H kids, and on and on that have come to these workshops and events, and they've all had some kind of life-changing experience.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's those kinds of experiences that you remember for the rest of your life and that truly change who you are to someone better.
Right.
And so, I guess I found my purpose in, I guess saving the world with archaeology.
That's right. Yeah. It's so relevant to so many things that we have in our world today, from just the obvious one about learning from the past, you know, which I think people sort of take for granted sometimes, but also learning how to respect the present and ultimately the future as well. So, yeah. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for coming on, Samantha. Richie and I are going to wrap up with some few other things. So we'll let you go now. But again, thank you for coming on. And when the podcast comes out, I'll let you know and you can share that out with other people so they can learn even more about Project Archaeology. And again, the website is projectarchaeology.org, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, great. Well, thanks a lot. And hopefully we'll talk to you again soon. Are you going to the SAAs by any chance?
I am. I'm presenting there.
Oh, neat.
Well, visit me in the Wild Note booth.
With Girl Scouts, so.
Ooh, what are you going to be presenting on?
Some of the evaluations we've been doing with the Girl Scout groups and kind of the effectiveness of Project Archaeology with informal education.
Cool.
So.
Neat. Will it be any Girl Scout cookies?
No, actually, I might just bring some. Hey, that's a good idea. I'll do
right? Nice.
Well, then I will see you there then.
Absolutely. I'll be in the Wild Note booth in the exhibit hall, so come on by.
Hey.
All right.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you very much. And again, we'll talk to you next time. Thank you.
Hey, Chris Webster jumping in one last time to mention our affiliate page. Affiliates, like the other things, help us keep the lights on. So check them out at arcpodnet.com and head over to the shop page and you can see /side hustle for a digital marketing course taught by a friend of mine, Seth Himes, or Timular, T-I-M-E-U-L-A-R, which is a great little time cube that I've got marking my time right here for this podcast editing. And helps with project management, everything. If you need to track your time, if you're required to turn in a timesheet and you work at a desk, hell, even if you don't work at a desk, you can just use this on the app. So, but check it out, arcpodnet.com/timular. And then if you're interested in a side hustle, digital marketing, something to do on the side, or maybe even a new career, so you can have time to listen to all these fantastic podcasts and work from home, then check it out at arcpodnet.com/side hustle. All right, back to the show.
All right, so what did you think about that, Richie?
I feel like they're turning out better prepared archaeologists than some of the universities I've heard of.
Right? You know, one thing I didn't ask, because I didn't really get the sense that it was a major focus. I mean, they did talk about GIS, but
yeah.
I was wondering, kind of just in the back of my head, how much of an emphasis when they go out and see the archaeological sites and they get to do stuff and they get those practical tools, how much of a focus on more digital methods current to today? You know, are they recording these things on paper?
Probably.
Or are you teaching them? So,
well, it looks like it because you get, or was it? I just scrolled down a little too far.
Yeah.
Where was it?
Well, while you're looking for that, you know, it's something we were talking about on the drive in here today. I saw a post from a well-known archaeology firm or environmental firm, and they were teaching teens in a high school setting how to do archaeology and taking them out to sites, and they're having them record stuff, and it was all on paper. And my kind of thought was, okay, I understand how career archaeologists might be resistant to the digital age a little bit. They might be resistant to that, which, okay, take it or leave it. You know, it is what it is. But if you want to get new young people excited about this field, it's not just going to be about telling the stories about the past and the present and learning from that. You got to bring in some more. I mean, these are millennials and beyond. Are teenagers today even millennials right now? I mean, is there another generation behind millennial yet?
Maybe.
But anyway, they grew up with technology and digital stuff in their hands, and maybe they want a little bit of a release from that and do some archaeology. But I'm thinking, to get them excited, we need to bring technology into the game as well. And I sound like a broken record when talking about that. But anyway, let me just say one more time here for this show, if you've got any questions, we let Samantha go, but I'm sure we can answer your questions and talk about it. So you're listening to KMVC 95.1 FM, Carson City Community Media. Call in 775-515-4141. You can tweet your questions to @ArchaeoWebby or @ArcPodNet. And also, Richie is live streaming this, so you can see us in the studio, facebook.com/ArcPodNet.
Open?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah, that should be. All right, good. Yeah, so go check that out.
Cool.
And you can see that there. So one of the last things I wanted to talk about is something I was talking about with Richie just recently. So I recently started using what they call a micro podcasting platform called Chirp.
Mm.
And it's these, you know, 10 seconds to 3 minute long short audio bursts, basically. And I've just kind of been experimenting with the platform. Well, I searched archaeology and it transcribes everything that you say automatically, so that's searchable. And somebody mentioned the word archaeology, and I listened to this this gentleman talk about he has kind of a side passion for archaeology. It's not what he does for a living.
Yeah.
But he's voicing his frustration with real archaeologists. I think I don't remember how he phrased that, like career archaeologist or real archaeologist, however he said. And he said how we're so short-sighted in how we look at the world. And his main example was looking at pyramids in Egypt and then looking at pyramids or similar structures in, say, South America, forgetting pyramidal structures around the world, but looking at Egypt and South America and looking at the time frame for these things and saying it just seems like it's impossible that they didn't communicate in one way or another. Like he said, first off, he's like, they had the same, if not better technology than we do today, which is a weird statement. But he said the same, if not better technology than today, it seems unlikely that they didn't have a boat that could get them across the ocean. And I'm thinking, was there a delegation of Egyptians that came over and taught the Mayans how to build pyramids? I mean, probably not. You know, we would have other cultural artifacts.
And more importantly, what for?
Well, yeah, why would they do that? I mean, there's always the exploration thing. You know, I'm sure people tried to explore. They went places. That's how North America was populated to begin with.
Yeah.
It's people chasing game and migration and things like that, looking for a better life like people are always doing and continuing to follow the path. So, but my big takeaway from this is people need to understand that archaeology, while rooted in history and always seems a little more related to storytelling, is a science. And if there were proof that, and trust me, people are looking for it, because there really does seem like there would be some sort of correlation between, say, Egypt and South America and Central America. And if there were proof of that joining, then we would be writing about it. We would be talking about it.
Oh, because I thought we were hiding it because we're part of the Illuminati.
I think that's probably the truth right there. Yeah. So it just doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't make any sense to me. You know, why we can have those theories. And that's all that is a theory.
Yeah.
And it's not a fact yet. It's a theory that's relatively unsupported. And I guess one good correlation to that is Vikings. So there was thought that Vikings reached North America a long time ago just through writings and stuff like that. And then people started looking in logical places to look for Vikings, which would be, northeastern United States and up into Canada there.
Yeah.
Why can't I think of the name? Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, that area, there. Yeah. So, and then Greenland, you know, but further over. So, and we know Vikings settled on Greenland.
Yeah.
And so we're like, let's find these sources. Let's find these sites. And now we're finding all kinds of sites because we know where to look. You know, we're looking in these places and we have pretty solid evidence that Vikings landed here. So they were the first quote, Europeans before well before Columbus to actually visit North America. Now, the thing is, they didn't stick around. They either died when they got here or they left. I don't know what happened. But you can't find their DNA in any descendants because if they did, you know, pair off with some of the Native Americans, it wasn't enough to make it propagate through the system.
Although, remember that controversy was, oh, God, what was it, Kennewick Man? And how he's supposed to look like, was it, you know, the dude who played, was on Star Trek.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's a different story.
Patrick Stewart.
Patrick Stewart, right. Well, Kennewick Man was, what, 9,000, dated to 9,000 years old, I think, down in Kennewick, Washington, Washington State. And somebody did a facial reconstruction, for people that don't know the story.
Yeah.
They did a facial reconstruction, and controversially, facial reconstructions are not 100% accurate.
No.
Like, there's a little bit of bias put in by the reconstructor.
Yeah.
And they made him look like somebody from Europe. And a lot of people said it looked like Patrick Stewart. So, which immediately threw it into question, because once they did DNA analysis, I mean, it's clear that there's Native American ancestry there.
Yeah.
You know, very clear. And that's one of the ways we can tell that some of these stories have no validity to them. Like, for example, if Egyptians visited South or Central America, or conversely, if they visited Egypt, right? If they stayed there for any length of time, and then, you know, it's entirely possible that they died soon after they got there, or they just didn't, I guess, mate with the locals, right?
Yeah.
Because it would have to be a lot of that to see evidence of that DNA in populations today. And we've got quite a bit of DNA evidence that says that just didn't happen. Now, like I said, if it was one delegation, well, my question is, if a bunch of Egyptians got here on a boat, probably starved, half dehydrated, and, you know, tired of being on the ocean for 6 months, the first thing they would have done is not say, wow, those shacks don't look very solid. Let me show you how to build a pyramid. I just don't think that's how it would have gone.
You know, I mean, God, it makes me think of agriculture and how we are pretty sure it just popped up in various parts of the world, like, independently. It's not like there was, like, a Johnny Appleseed of agriculture going around teaching each individual culture how to, you know, plant feed, you know, seeds.
Right. And people might be somewhat confused by that because you hear about the Fertile Crescent, like Iran, Iraq, that area there. That's just where we're pretty sure agriculture started first, but that doesn't mean they taught everyone else how to do it.
No. Or, you know, or, you know, the emergence of, like, primitive figurines, like, that all probably started right around the same time, but it's not like every culture, like, there was, like, some art teacher going around.
I know. It's weird. The weird thing to me, and I think this is the reading I've done, and I don't know what the current thinking on this, so don't take this, you know, and quote me on this, but the interesting thing to me is how a lot of these things, a lot of these technologies that we take for granted around the world, like just the easy one, the invention of the wheel, fire, stuff like that, then agriculture, different projectile points or what most people call arrowheads, the shapes of those are changed through time. But a lot of these different technologies around the world kind of came around at similar times, right? They came around maybe separated by a couple thousand years, but they came around at similar times. And I think the reading I've done has said that's more related to human brain development than anything else. Like, we were developing as a species and developing into a species that could come up with these things. And it just so happened that the need based on, you know, what we're able to think of at that time and what we need, we were putting those two together and coming up with the technology we needed.
Interesting. All right.
But then some stuff, like if you've heard of the Clovis point, if you're listening to this, that's such a weird thing to me. Because it's one thing that we typically call the Clovis point.
Yeah.
There's different variations of it, but it's basically called the Clovis point across all of North America and parts of South America.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and it's like this thing's all over the place. But then we've got other points, other projectile points that we call them, because a little bit of a lesson right there. We don't necessarily call everything arrowheads like that because they weren't always on the tips of arrows.
Really?
There's lots of different things. There's darts, atlatl darts, the big ones, little crossbow darts. There's actual arrows. So we call them all projectile points. Now, if you specifically know what something was on, I guess you could call it that. But archaeologists just typically call it a projectile point.
Yeah.
So anyway, we've got shapes here, like the Elko corner notch projectile point is a pretty common one. It was around for, what, something like 3,000 years, give or take, with little variation in the Great Basin.
Yeah, it's like, you know what, the teardrop shape one with the notches in the bottom?
Or it's got notches. Well, it's hard to describe on radio podcast, but
that's true.
Look up Elko projectile point or Elko corner notch or, you know, Elko side notch, stuff like that. So anyway, that shape of projectile point, though, while we call it here in the Great Basin, we call it the Elko point, that shape is not unique.
No.
That shape's all over the country.
Yeah.
That shape's all over South America. That shape's all over Europe.
Yeah, because it works. It's like, you know, there's a reason why there aren't square planes.
I know, exactly. Airplanes are shaped the same way because that's what makes them fly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, cars have four wheels and a steering wheel because that's how they go.
Although they didn't always have them.
Well, that's true. That's true. They have evolved a little bit.
Yeah.
So I guess my point is that archaeologists aren't trying to make their own narrative, because what would be the point of that? You know, we try to write narratives based on the given evidence. Now, some people might conjecture a little too far and say, well, I think this, you know, we found this, therefore I think this may happen. If they write it correctly, they'll state it as an opinion and not a statement of fact.
Yeah, but then you could say the same thing about climate change scientists, and yet people are always making up facts, reasons about why they're, like, hiding all the information, all the real truth.
Well, now you're getting in trouble.
I know.
Yeah. So.
Trying to bring up my weird hat.
I know. You know, we've had a few minutes left on this. I'd really love somebody to call in with their question or theory about archaeology, 775-515-4141, because I'm really interested in what people think out there. You know, I'm really interested in what people have to say and what they think about archaeologists, especially here in Nevada, because I know there's a kind of a love-hate relationship with archaeologists here in Nevada, because any land with a lot of public lands and leased public lands, people are always afraid that, you know, something's going to be found on their land and then the government's going to take it or something like that.
Yeah, I feel like we're not as hated as biologists. And what was – I always forget the bird that everyone's freaking
like
about.
Like the sage grouse or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, sage grouse. Yeah.
Like I was in a – I was at the – I was having something altered, like a jacket or something altered in Reno. That was the first thing that someone wanted to talk to me about.
Nice.
Was the sage grouse.
Yeah, yeah. It's either that or dinosaurs.
Oh, well, it depends on where you are, because I was once in, Lovelock, and someone wanted to talk to me about the red-headed giants of Lovelock.
Oh, listen, every time I get my haircut, I get the same guy, and it's just luck of the draw. I always get this one guy, and he always brings up the red-headed giants of Lovelock.
See?
And he's like, you ever going to go out there? And he knows my feelings on that.
You know? What are they?
Yeah, well, there's no giants. Let me just put it that way.
What?
There's no giants.
What?
Maybe there's taller people, but there's no giants. It's all stories, right? Again, it goes back to proof. There used to be a great podcast on the Archaeology Podcast Network called Archaeological Fantasies.
Oh, yeah.
And go check it out. It's no longer on the APN. Mm-mm. Just type in Archaeological Fantasies, and I'm sure you'll probably find the APN page. But, you know, look back at our previous episodes. She's got over 70 episodes on that, but also look up the new podcast, because Sarah Head is the host, and she's got a couple of co-hosts that have written extensively about what we call pseudo-archaeology, or and that's a really nice term to say fake archaeology, and it's not always just fake archaeology that they talk about, like people actively misleading people, but sometimes it's theories that people have that are based on things they really believe, like they're not trying to mislead anyone.
Well, the thing is, people, like we were talking about in the car on the way over, people, find that their own narrative or a narrative, like they try to impose a narrative on history.
Yeah.
You know, because sometimes it just looks neater that way.
Yeah.
You know, like, did George Washington really cross the Delaware with his, like, one foot up on, looking like Captain Morgan?
Yeah, probably not. He's probably huddled down in the boat like everybody else.
Bah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's just how it was painted.
I know.
You know? So. Anyway, I really want to know your guys' theories out there. So when we come around, we'll come around again live. Speaking of, I'm going to be actually doing archaeology for the next 3 weeks.
Oh, same here.
Yeah, Richie's going on this project with me. Plus, we're going to a conference that we mentioned today on the show in Albuquerque, one of the bigger archaeology, probably the biggest archaeology conference in the United States for sure.
Yeah.
And in probably much of the world. I mean, there's 4,000 people that go to this thing. So,
yeah.
But we'll be doing that. So the next 3 episodes will be episodes from the Archaeology Podcast Network. So don't call in, but feel free to go over to the Archaeology Podcast Network and leave a comment. You can always leave a comment on these episodes. And feel free to reach out to any one of the sources that we've mentioned already. So
interesting. You ever gotten a comment?
I get comments all the time.
You do?
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't say all the time, which I think means we have satisfied listeners. But, who knows? So Richie, kind of wrapping up the show here, what are some of the more crazy things you've heard people say as an archaeologist? Can you think of anything? Like some sort of crazy theory they had or something like that? I mean, obviously there's ancient aliens, which could be a whole show.
You know, what's interesting about that is actually I knew a real archaeologist who was a researcher on that show.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do they still have a career?
It's L.A.
Yeah.
They're always going to need researchers for stuff like that.
Well, I guess so.
But most of the time, I usually just shut that down by, like, you know, telling them something like, you know, I'm a biologist.
so you lie completely.
Yeah. Well, I mean, most people actually assume that I'm a geologist when I say archaeologist. They just, like, I don't know what it is. Something about goes to the mind. Maybe it's the hat.
Maybe it's the hat.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, like I said, you know, take a look at those things that you hear out on the internet and on TV and things like that, and really think about it critically. Think about it with a critical eye, and just assume that maybe there's other sciences where people are really you know, funneling in some conspiracies for some reason or another.
Yeah.
But there's literally no money in archaeology. Like, there's no money, there's no funding, there's a little bit of funding, but you got to really stretch for it. So nobody's doing this for the money. There's no big archaeology, right? There's no, like, overarching, you know, archaeology conspiracy out there. So if there's some theory, I know, at least I haven't been invited into it, which I'm a little sad about. So if there's some theory that you think is real, like ancient aliens or Atlantis or, you know, Egyptians and South Americans having a powwow down on the coast, then really kind of think about that and think about what the reasons for, and think like a scientist and say, hey, if that were true, what other things would be there? Like, with going back to the Viking example, there's other things there. Once we found some landing sites, we were able to find structures that they built and artifacts, things that we can tie back to where the Vikings came from, right? So we can definitely tie those back. And if there were common enough Egyptian landing sites or South American landing sites, even in Africa, if that was, they would have had to have done it several times and a lot just to impart this sort of technology and to get it right.
Yeah.
If that were true, there would be corresponding artifacts. There would be corresponding sites. And I guarantee you, those would be earth-shattering revelations, and no archaeologist in the right mind would sit on that information. They would publish it, and they would get their History Channel special, and they would, you know, ride that theory all the way to the bank.
Maybe.
I think it's true. I think it's actually true. So,
yeah.
Anyway. All right. Well, we're starting to wrap up here. Thanks for coming on, Richie.
Yeah, no
really,
problem.
Really appreciate that. Yeah. Again, go check out arcpodnet.com and /archaeology if you want to see everything about this show. And again, I'm going to be gone for the next 3 weeks, but we'll have a show in its place, so definitely listen to that. You can't call in, but you can definitely tweet at ArchaeoWebby, ArcheoWebby. You can tweet at ArcPodNet, and then, you know, you can always call into the station, 775-515-4141, and they'll let you know when we're coming back live again, I'm sure.
Yay. So,
yeah. Well, anyway, Richie, again, thanks for coming on. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And we're going to play out the theme music for a little bit here. And again, arcpodnet.com. And, of course, go over to knvc.org to find all the other great shows that we have coming out of Carson City, Nevada here, because you can listen to them all on live anywhere around the world.
That's true.
Yeah, knvc.org/listen-live. All right. Thanks a lot, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.